self-destruct in under an 8. Further, it'll self-destruct if my vital signs cease.
Bind his hands, Saint said on a private channel to the Marines. Over his speakers, he replied, We'll see about that.
He pulled a small disc from his pouch and slapped it onto a control surface. After a minute, Pandora's voice came across the bridge speakers.
I have access to all systems, Gunnery Sergeant. I've locked the enemies into their compartments, and it'll take some time for them to breach. We're in control of the ship. The self-destruction is offline. However, as there hasn't been enough time to fully explore everything, it's possible there's a secondary device connected to his vital signs, as he claims.
Saint said, Key. There was the hiss of escaping gas, and the enemy commander dropped to the floor. Saint knelt next to him and patted him on the shoulder.
This will hold you for a while. Nice try, though. Guess our limited minds still have some surprises for you bastards.
The rest of the aliens on the bridge succumbed to the toxin, and the room fell silent. He seated himself in the command chair and triggered the communication link to the Washington. Lieutenant Fitzpatrick extended the connection to include Kate, Claire, and Sinner as well.
Watch this, Saint said,
and with a wave instructed Pandora to take the action they'd planned. The carrier's weapons reached out and speared the last remaining enemy ship, reducing it to its components in an instant.
Nice shooting, Kate said.
You know it, Commander. We're Marines, after all.
Cross chuckled without mirth.
All right. Get mop-up operations underway, Saint. Clear those hangars. We have a lot of fighters with dwindling air supplies and no place to call home.
Affirmative, he replied and gave the requisite commands.
When you're done over there, we'll send over the transport crew to take that ship home.
Saint frowned.
Kate got to keep her ship, he complained.
Cross laughed, for real.
Such are the vagaries of war, Gunnery Sergeant. Turns out we have to take a little detour before we return to the fleet, and your particular set of skills will be required.
Affirmative. Saint John out.
He killed the channel and connected to Sinner.
You get all that?
Already on it, Saint.
He straightened in his seat, and in his pristine accent said,
That's Captain Saint to you, Gunnery Sergeant Cynthia Murphy, while you're on board my vessel.
Yes, sir, Captain Saint, sir,
she replied.
Allow me to suggest exactly what you should do with your vessel.
Her suggestion, as usual, was both cheerfully vulgar and anatomically impossible.
Chapter 21
The conversation paused, and Emperor Kratatok took the moment to regard the members of the mob milling around his throne. From his vantage point on the platform at the top of the stairs, they looked small and unimportant, dressed in their ill-fitting finery and dawdling in hope of gaining influence or status, or simply seeing something important and unexpected. In the first two, he had no interest. In the latter, he'd soon deliver a spectacle of which their paltry imaginations could not possibly conceive. He tuned back in to the steady voice of his seneschal.
So, as you can see, all your orders have been properly carried out.
Every single traitor on the list?
Yes, Emperor. Those on whom we have incontrovertible evidence are no longer among the living. Those we were less positive about have been imprisoned.
Krada grunted. The lack of clear proof was a sticking point on which his advisers, excluding Varen, agreed. They argued the rabble wouldn't take his personal insight into his enemies' hearts and spirits as proof worthy of execution. He shrugged mentally. In time, they'd come to understand what obedience to the chosen vessel of the gods meant.
And our investigations into those not on the original list
have been undertaken with great energy, replied Chani.
Krata thought his most trusted attendant looked uncomfortable. Perhaps the collar of his tunic was too tight. For an instant, his vision slipped, and the man resembled nothing more than a giant worm in a uniform. He shook his head slightly, and things returned to normal. Lack of discipline. None of them saw what he saw, None of them understood the vital importance of the moment about to be born, or they'd welcome the opportunity to separate those who believed from those who pretended with the most aggressive methods of truth-seeking and punishment.
"Time," Crotta growled.
The Seneschal fumbled an ornate watch from his vest and examined it.
"Approximately 2 minutes, Your Grace,"
he grunted again.
"Tell me, Chani, what are the people saying about my reign?"
He waved a lazy hand to indicate the minuscule beings below. This must be what the gods saw when they looked down upon the greatest among us.
"They are filled with respect, Emperor.
And the ones who are not?"
"They are in the minority, and fear to speak too loudly lest their fellows act against them."
Crotta leaned forward and spread his wings, flicking them in the fashion of the warriors of old, who secreted light blades along their feathers to surprise their enemies.
"Very good. Events are moving toward, perhaps, the most pivotal period in our entire history. Increase the number of informants among them. Any hint of treachery should be met with the blade, not with manacles."
Chani looked at his feet and mumbled,
"Yes, Your Grace, it will be done."
"Time?"
45 seconds, Your Grace."
The man's voice trembled as he continued speaking.
"Perhaps mercy would be the better choice on this occasion, Emperor."
Crotta laughed and adopted a regal posture atop the throne.
"That's why I keep you around, Chani. You're the wounded conscience to Varen's unceasing aggression."
He felt a tingle of anticipation and said,
"Speak of the demon, and she shall appear."
The doors to the throne room swung wide, and a guard's voice announced,
"The Emperor's protector."
She walked in, trailed by a circle of guards, prodding at something in the center to advance. Her black cowl and robes hid her features from the surrounding rabble. From his inclined angle, he could see the scars on her face, some of them recent reminders of battles won in his service. He nodded to her, a grandiose gesture that would convey his respect for the assassin to all those assembled. When she reached the foot of the dais, she knelt and intoned,
"Traitors, as commanded, Emperor."
He stood and brushed his hands down the front of his ceremonial robes. His stomach fluttered in anticipation, and the memory of sweetness, of honey, played across his tongue. This moment was far sweeter than any morsel could ever be. As he descended the first step, his seneschal raced ahead, gesturing at the guards below. The protective detail at the base of the dais spread out and used persuasion and force in equal measures to block the onlookers away from the center aisle. When they'd finished, the Emperor had an unobstructed path to the protective circle of his guards.
"You've done well, my protector," he announced as he reached the bottom of the stairs.
He laid a hand on her head and murmured a small prayer. When he lifted it, she rose to stand at his side, the seemingly casual placement of her hands putting her centimeters from her weapons. Chani joined them in the approach.
"Make way for the Emperor, fools,"
hissed Varen, and the guards recoiled, moving aside. But they still remained close enough to intervene at the slightest threat from the traitors they'd delivered to the Emperor. The woman and her two children huddled in a bunch on their knees. The mother pushed her children behind her as the circle opened and stood to interpose herself between them and the Emperor. Crotta stopped his guard's response with a raised hand and turned to address one side of the throne room.
"Before you, you see the partner and offspring of N'Jara Kria, who was proven to be a traitor and received his just punishment in the cathedral on the last holy day."
He paced as he warmed to his speech. He brought up his palms in a wide gesture of inclusion.
"Who among you thinks of mercy right now?"
He spun to point at the other half of the throne room.
"Which of you believes that surely the guilty has been punished already?"
Crotta clasped his arms behind his back.
Of course you are. You all are. Even, dare I say, one of my most trusted attendants is at this very instant of the opinion that mercy would be the correct route.
He speared Chani with a glare, silencing any consideration of speaking he might have possessed.
Even the gods themselves!
He raised his arms, palms flat toward the heavens, then continued,
Even the gods believe in mercy. Isn't that right?
He paused and paced to give the mob a moment to employ the limited functionality of its intellect.
However, the Dadas is as clear as diamond on this matter. It says a traitor to the gods shall not be permitted to live. And so, Injera Kriya received the just reward for his choices.
He schooled his voice to change roles from accuser to teacher.
But are we to believe he acted alone, that he never once spoke of his dissatisfaction, never once spoke of his plans?
He turned to face the pathetic creatures huddled before him.
Are we to imagine his secrecy was so perfect that on not one single occasion did his partner or his children overhear his treason?
Krada let the questions hang in the air for a moment before resuming.
But you have no proof, some of you are thinking, even now. This belief is only possible because you haven't accepted the truth. The truth of the gods, as delivered through their words and as spoken to their avatar in the mortal realm.
He walked in silence to stand beside his assassin.
The gods say these beings are stained with their loved ones' treason, and there's a singular punishment for such transgressions.
Krada raised his arms against the outbreak of murmurs in the room.
In respect for your uncertainty and for your good and kind hearts, I'll permit the guilty before you to speak.
He leveled a sneer at the woman.
What say you, traitor, partner of a traitor, parent of traitors?
Something in her hardened as he watched. Her spine stiffened and her chin rose.
It was my intent to ask for clemency for our children, knowing as I do that their innocence and my own wouldn't be adequate to protect us from your misplaced vengeance. But now I'll do no such thing. You have made the gods into an excuse for your own unrighteous behavior, Hierarch.
She injected her own sneer into his title.
And the gods will surely bring you down, and all who support you will fall along with you.
He nodded and hoped the crowd would properly read his expression as confirmation of his worst fears about the woman and her children. Behind his back, he felt the touch of metal as it pressed against his palm. She drew in a breath to speak again, and Krada extended his arm, discharging a single round from the projectile pistol in his hand. The gun was yet another relic of the early, violent days of the church. Each bullet was blessed by a priest, and the gun held only six. It was an instrument of faith, not a weapon of war. Before the first bullet reached its target, he lowered his aim and fired twice more. A scream emanated from somewhere among the mob and echoed throughout the chamber. Then it stilled, as if cut off by a protective hand. The three traitors dropped without a response, perfect headshots having ended each of their opportunities to betray him permanently. The smoky scent of the powder wafted to him, and he inhaled in satisfaction. Krada handed the pistol back to Varen, then turned in a slow circle to properly address all the rabble in the throne room.
Now you see the treatment the gods demand us to deliver to all traitors. Now you understand what faithfulness and honor to those above means. Carry the word. Let
Others know the truth of our gods, and the truth of our place in the world as subject to their will. Do this," he paused, and the silence spoke eloquently, "lest you also find yourself judged."
He wrapped his robes around him and motioned for his protector to attend.
"Chani, see that this is cleaned up."
His seneschal moved with a jerk, responding to his snapped instructions as if he was awakening from a trance.
"Yes, Emperor,"
he whispered, then choked and coughed.
"As you command."
Krata bestowed a nod of approval upon him and swept from the room with Varin by his side. His mind was already at work on plans to force more traitors to reveal themselves, so they, too, could earn their rewards. Chapter 22 The Pandora emerged from the gravity wave to discover the Washington hanging at its tunnel point, near the edge of the system. Kate hit the buttons to initiate contact.
"Any problems in transit?"
Cross laughed.
"A few loose bolts, deck plates, and the like. No big deal. All in a day's work for Janik and his team."
"Somehow I don't think he sees it that way."
Another laugh in his deep, but not too deep, voice. She really enjoyed the sound. It made something grow warm in her soul.
"Safe bet. How's the Pandora?"
Pandora's avatar shimmered to life beside her.
"I'm fine, Captain Cross, and thank you for asking."
"Have you detected any problems?"
Kate asked. The ship answered,
"Affirmative, Commander. The installation is on high alert."
"That's the state we found the other base in."
"Interesting," she said.
"That's inaccurate, Commander. This station is at a level of alert several steps above the previous one we visited, but not at the maximum."
"What would the maximum be?"
Cross asked.
"War,"
Pandora replied in the same calm, matter-of-fact tone. Kate turned to the screen and imagined him doing the same. When their eyes met, even through the remote connection, she felt them boring into her.
"Okay, then. We're in the lead. Stay on our six, Ace."
"You got it, Red,"
he said with a smile, then disconnected. She checked her display, noting the telltales that signaled unimpeded communication with the Washington's computer.
"Here we go."
Kate's fingers brushed the designators for thrust and direction, and the Pandora heeled over to point at the innocent-looking gap in the asteroid field surrounding the base.
"Should we expect the same surprises as last time?"
she asked.
"Yes, Commander Flynn, and possibly additional ones."
"Great,"
said Lieutenant Santiago Diaz in the most sarcastic tone she'd ever heard from him.
"You love it, Diaz. Don't deny it." "You always take me to the nicest places, Commander,"
he replied. Then they were in the field, and her tactical officer's attention was occupied with angling the shields in response to blasts from weapons hidden among the giant rocks. Kate targeted and fired as fast as she could, sending energy bolts out to intercept incoming torpedoes before they could get close enough to deplete the close defense ammunition. And she sent her own missiles on arcing courses toward laser and plasma emplacements. Her eyes widened as a brace of torpedoes dodged her beams and separated onto spiraling paths.
"Incoming torpedoes,"
Kate said, and tapped their icons on her control board to mark them.
"On it,"
Diaz said, and the point defense cannons chattered. Again, the targets evaded.
"Pandora?"
Kate asked.
"An advanced version of our torpedoes, used only for installation defense due to the difficulty of manufacture. Each has an artificial intelligence aboard."
The torpedoes opened up with their own lasers as they neared.
"Those things pack a wallop, Commander,"
Diaz said. Kate flicked her eyes up to the shield strength information on the main display and saw that the shields were failing rapidly.
"Rolling,"
Kate said, and twisted the ship into a roll to bring undamaged defenses against the incoming barrage. She sketched out vectors on her control board and sent them to the Washington. A light flickered in an affirmative reply, and she smiled.
"Watch this."
She fired bolts of energy at the torpedoes again, and they reached as before, one ascending and the other descending to avoid the blasts. Lasers and plasma from the Washington enveloped them as she covered the area inside the kill box she'd defined with weapons from a full broadside. The torpedoes detonated far enough away that the shrapnel was rendered harmless by the Pandora's shields.
"Thanks, Walsh,"
she breathed, and jerked the Pandora into a climb to avoid one of the rocks that had gravity locked onto her ship. The asteroid was dragged upward, the pull dragging down the Pandora's acceleration. The Washington launched missiles against it, but only succeeded in knocking some of the rock's mass away. Kate selected drill torpedoes and fired them from aft ports. She targeted them on the portions of the rock surrounding the likely location of the gravity generator, and they drilled into the asteroid before exploding. The asteroid shattered, and the projector, now separated from its power unit, fell away inert.
"Any sign of enemy ships?"
"No, Commander."
"Theories as to why this base, operating at a higher defense status, does not have them when the other one did?"
"None, Commander. I don't have data to speculate. Perhaps, once we're inside the facility, we'll be able to determine the reason."
They jetted free of the asteroid field, trading shots with and finally eliminating a last set of cannon emplacements. Kate realized she'd been clenching her teeth and gently worked her jaw to loosen it. Ahead, the Dameki space station swam in the starscape. It was striking in its elegance, a shining metallic crescent, long and wide, but probably only a few decks deep. What looked like loading points appeared at irregular intervals. At the far end, not attached but close enough for easy access, hung a repair scaffold. Lieutenant Linda Peterson whistled.
"That's one beautiful station."
"No question," Kate said. "You can see the design similarities in the crescent and in the lines of the Pandora."
She triggered the connection to cross.
"Come through okay?"
He nodded, a look of respect on his face.
"I'll say one thing for the Dameki. They sure do know how to build."
Cross's image was replaced with an exterior view which showed cannons mounted along the top portion of the base, swiveling to target them.
"Shields forward," Kate snapped, and the ship's defenses weathered the first volley.
After the attempt for a quick kill, the weapons settled into an unpredictable pattern of fire, maintaining a continuous assault on her defenses.
"We're going to have to make a run along the surface," she said.
She hit the controls to put the ship into a dive and saw the Washington react to echo her movements. A grin tugged at the corner of her mouth as she remembered the fighter trial against the Lubyanka at the academy. The smile was quickly replaced by a stern line as she focused on the task at hand. Kate used the Pandora as a blocker, interposing her ship wherever possible between the enemy weapons and the damaged Washington. When she failed to knock out a weapon in passing, she trusted to Walsh and Cross to eliminate it. At the finish of their first run, 2/3 of the turrets were destroyed. A quick half-circle brought them back to do the same to the rest, and both ships coasted to a stop above the base.
"I have control of the airlock through the housekeeping systems, as before, Commander."
"I guess we should count ourselves lucky they didn't figure out that trick."
"Indeed, Commander. I recommend you move quickly."
Kate slapped the release for her security straps and said,
"Yes, ma'am, Captain Pandora."
She turned and dashed from the bridge. Her gauntlets slid into place at the end of her outstretched arms. At the same moment, her boots finished wrapping her feet. An instant later, the helmet lowered and locked with a comforting click. The display came up instantly, and the suit greeted her. She stepped forward into the arming room and made her way to the weapons wall. She chose standard armaments, as well as a set of electrical grenades Pandora believed would prove effective against the automatons that served as security at the last base. With a frown of reflection on that experience, she threw a pack of the devices to each member of her boarding party.
"Let's get to it," Kate commanded.
"Stand by, Commander," replied Pandora.
A series of metallic clangs resounded through the ship.
"Please step outside the violet line," she instructed,
and a circle filling the middle third of the room appeared. When the Marines had stepped beyond circumference, the previously seamless floor split apart into curved and pointed sections that dropped several centimeters and irised open. Below, they could see a similar hole reaching down through multiple decks to reveal the surface of the Dameki station.
"That's a nice feature, Pandora."
"Thank you, Commander.
Traditionally, the Domeki's foot soldiers deploy through the bottom of the ship. We haven't previously been positioned appropriately to do so.
Do I feel gravity? Kate asked.
Negative, Commander. What you sense is pressure being generated by gas pumped into the opening. It will act much like gravity and carry you smoothly down.
That thing's not going to move out of the way while we're jumping, is it?
The chances are minimal. However, you can attach a tether before you jump, if you're concerned.
Kate shook her head invisibly inside her armor. The ship's intelligence was becoming spikier as time passed. It felt like an intervention was in order, but she was completely unsure of how to accomplish such a thing with a computer-based life form.
One for the neuroscientists and programmers to fight about, I guess, she thought. Okay, Wickerns, you're the first, she ordered.
He hit the release for his tether and grappled it to the attachment point. He pulled the rifle from his back and, with a joyful shout, leapt into the hole. Her crew crowded around and watched as he touched down gently and slid several steps to the side, his weapon traversing a full circle in its quest for a target.
Clear,
he reported, and the rest of the team jumped to the base. A kilometer away, Kate could see the tiny forms of the Washington's Marines bailing out and firing grapnel guns to bring them down to the surface of the station. The two forces moved to a spot precisely halfway between them. Their oversized steps in the absence of gravity made the approach almost comical. As they drew near, the hatch of what appeared to be a large cargo airlock opened. Both teams jumped into it, then greeted one another with fist bumps and armored high fives. Their suits negotiated in the background, and after several seconds the hiss of their shared communication channel was added to the helmet's soundscape.
Nice of you to come along, Kate said.
As if we'd miss out on the chance to work with you again, Commander Flynn, Saint replied.
In a conspiratorial whisper, Sinner added,
Don't let him know I told you, Red, but I think he has a crush on you.
Her external speakers picked up the clang as Saint backhanded the other gunnery sergeant in the chest, and both teams laughed. Without warning, the airlock closed above them, and the hiss of pressure equalization filled the space.
Game faces, Saint said.
Both teams drew their weapons and turned toward the part of the room that would open into the base. As the door retracted, a set of four sentries, each featuring a large sphere at the bottom of its torso instead of humanoid legs, careened into the corridor beyond it. Kate and Saint yelled,
Fire!
In unison, and the battle for the Domeki Crescent Station was on. Chapter 23 The battle was over before it began. The barrage of weapons flew mainly over top the sentries as they threw themselves flat on the ground to avoid them, or at least that was how it looked. Pandora's smooth voice cut in and said,
I've eliminated the defenders, Commander, and gunnery sergeants. I'm now shutting down active defenses throughout the base.
Great work, Pandora, Kate replied as she stood up from her defensive crouch. How did you manage access?
I was able to use your suits as a bridge, Commander. Once you were inside, I discovered a path through some engineering systems that allowed me into the security controls.
Kate shook her head.
You're something else. Could you?
Her request was rendered redundant as three different colored paths appeared on her heads-up display.
The yellow path leads to the command center for the base. The blue path leads to a cargo bay with an external lock. The Washington, D.C. is moving to that cargo bay. The green path leads to a resupply station for Domeki vessels. I'm repositioning to lock onto the hard point associated with it.
Kate frowned, unable to complain about anything in particular, but feeling somehow less in control of the situation than she'd like to be.
All right, you heard the lady. Diaz and I will head to command. The rest of my crew follow the green line and give Pandora what she wants. Saint? Sinner? You know the way.
Indeed, replied St. John. I'll accompany you, and Sinner can oversee the loading. Should we destroy these things for the sake of safety?
Wickerns asked. His rifle was still pointed at the downed robots. Silence reigned for a moment. Kate broke it.
If Pandora says she has them, I'm sure she has them. Let's not waste any time.
The Marine leaders didn't contradict her, and the groups moved out to their separate objectives. As they advanced toward the command center, Kate, Diaz, and Saint took turns investigating the chambers as they passed. They cataloged supply rooms, mess halls, barracks, and other important features of everyday life. None of it looked active or recently utilized. Reports came in from the other teams as they reached their objectives and reported nominal statuses there as well.
"Load quick," Kate ordered.
On a channel only to Saint and Diaz, she said,
"This place is giving me the creeps."
Chills had begun to course up and down her spine when the robots dropped, and the unreality of wandering through the seemingly normal, seemingly dormant Domeki base had been afflicting her ever since. Finally, they reached the control center, which was similar in layout to the previous one they'd encountered, but much larger. Kate slapped the Pandora disc onto a nearby display, and the room lit up.
"I'm negotiating additional routes into the full system," Pandora said. "There's no need to remain in the control area. I'll use your suit to bring the data outside the base, and you can retrieve the disc as you exit."
"Good deal," Kate replied, then addressed the two with her.
"Want to go exploring, or should we help with a transfer so we can get the hell out of here?"
"I vote the latter," said Diaz. "Seems I'm outvoted then," replied Saint, with a smile in his tone. "I, of course, would have chosen the bravest route, to stay here and extract every last bit of data from the aliens' cold, dead storage banks."
"Right, Saint. We know."
She gave him a pat on the shoulder to emphasize her understanding. She drew a deep breath, blew it out, and said,
"Let's move."
After a brisk run across at least half the station, Kate emerged into the resupply bay for the Pandora. She watched Saint's back as he diverted into a large area nearby. He turned and gave her a nod before leaving her line of sight. Then his voice crackled over the comm.
"Excellent choice to put the ship so close together."
"Thank you, Gunnery Sergeant," replied the growly tones of Captain Cross. "I live for your approval."
"Good that you finally admit it," Saint countered.
"Focus, boys," she said, and the channel fell into chatter about the logistics of loading. She moved to where her team clustered around a series of terminals.
"How's it going?"
Her engineer, Trey Winstell, replied,
"This is a fantastic system. We requisition what we want on that terminal," he pointed.
"Then robot arms in the storage space beyond retrieve it and put it onto this conveyor." A container appeared at that moment, floating above a gigantic yellow line on the floor.
"Repulsors in the crate?" she asked. "Nope. Appears to be pure gravity manipulation. If you take a magnified look, you can see all the surfaces of this room have tiny circular indentations. I think those are gravitic projectors. When this war is over, we have to come back here and dig into this place. The innovations we could develop based on it are just..."
His voice was filled with longing.
"Amazing." "I think Trey is in love,"
voked Jella Kazaya.
"I married a gigantic alien space station," announced Emily LaChance in a theatrical tone. "The rights from the book and movie alone will bring billions."
"Bastards! Cretans!" Winstell said with a laugh. "You could never understand the purity and beauty of our true love."
Kate frowned. Something was still chewing at the base of her brain. She could almost taste the metallic fear that came with the arrival of nasty surprises.
"Okay. Lock down the nonsense. Go faster, and don't forget to pull every schematic for advanced weapons you can find."
She received acknowledgments from her crew and sprinted to the Marines' loading bay. She slid to a sudden stop, startled at the sight of the Marines acting like children. Unable to use the gravity controls, they were using suit jets to push large crates into motion and direct them on a trajectory towards the waiting cargo bay on the Washington. The Marines resembled superheroes on holiday, every so often using a magnetic grapnel gun to reel themselves in or adjust the path of an errant container. Kate shook her head and walked back toward her own team without a word. When the warning came, it wasn't a surprise. It was simply a confirmation of the formless fear she'd been enduring.
"Commander Flynn, I've been contacted by a Domeki computer. The signal is originating at a 231-degree angle to the station." "You're saying that there's a Domeki presence in the system other than this one?" "That's the most likely explanation, Commander."
Kate triggered the channel that included everyone. Immediate evacuation. Whatever's not on board gets left behind. Make your way to the ship closest. There are Domeki in the system, and they're not on the base.
When Pandora joined the group discussion, Kate was struck by how alarmed her voice sounded.
I now have multiple Domeki contacts. They're attempting to breach my defenses. You don't have time to return to the entry airlock. Guess we get to be superheroes for real,
Sinner said.
All Marines, suit jets and grapnels over to the Washington's cargo bay. Latch on to the Marine next to you and go. Now, now, now!
Kate looked around the room to confirm that the only egress, other than the way she'd entered, was the tube leading through the bulkhead and feeding her ship.
We're coming through the tube, Pandora,
she yelled, and raced for the opening. She pulled team members into motion as she passed, sending them out ahead of her. She was the last to leap into the gravity stream, which grabbed her and sent her hurtling out of the base. The system hadn't been designed to carry people, and their arrival on the Pandora was decidedly inelegant. Kate was propelled into a large pile of armor-clad figures. She rebounded as she struck and rolled away to tumble down an irregular staircase of stacked crates until she hit the floor with enough velocity to jar her brain inside its tin can. Stars swam before her eyes, and she gasped in an effort to put words together.
Are we all here?
Affirmative,
Pandora said.
Button up, then. The Washington?
Already moving,
answered Lieutenant Commander Linda Peterson from her post on the bridge.
Do we have an unopposed exit vector?
Yes, Commander,
Pandora answered.
Great. Protect the DC and get us out of here once she's safe. If anything changes, if there's any danger, summon me. Otherwise, I'm going to sort out my people and head to medical.
Affirmative, Commander.
Pandora and Peterson replied together, or at least that's what Kate thought she heard as her brain tunneled down into darkness.
Chapter 24. Krata walked with purpose through the hewn rock of the tunnel that connected the palace and the Planetary Defense Center. Once again, his trusted pair of attendants trailed him, Chani on his right and Varan on his left, each a half pace behind. With each step, it felt as if he was drawing closer to an inevitable end. The confluences in play at this moment were unprecedented. The result of this war would change the Dzogchen culture for all time. He would go down in the annals of the Dzogchen as the leader who'd delivered them to paradise. He knew it with every fiber of his being. They came to the first guard post, and the Seneschal led the way. Several overprotective minutes later, they'd reached the primary level of the defense center. He regarded it with new eyes. Uniformed personnel moved throughout the space, intent on their tasks, unaware of or unconcerned with any larger issues at play. The perfect cogs in the perfect machine. The frosted windows of the main room in the middle kept it secret, and he always pictured it in his mind as it had been on the day this all began. The day the trespassers invaded the reliquary and destroyed the shrine of Vasoi. The greatest transgression in history had led to the greatest opportunity in history. Unprecedented moments indeed. Krata followed Chani into the heart of the center and regarded the hologram hanging over the planning table. The room fell silent, doubtless awaiting his orders. The sight of the defenders circling Zhrosha captivated him. Never before, during his time among the elite anyway, had so much of the fleet been gathered in one place. Historical records suggested that a similar mobilization occurred near the end of the war with the Domeki, but despite the evocative descriptions recorded for posterity, the image was too unreal to resolve in his mind. The present reality was more rewarding than his imagination could have ever been. A discreet throat clearing from an officer brought him back to the moment with a frown.
Report, he said in a level tone.
All is proceeding according to your plan, Emperor, replied High Commander Malus Fadl, his subordinate in charge of the defense of the home system. Our ships are arriving within acceptable tolerances of their projected times. Upon arrival, they're resupplied, rearmed, and set into position.
Rearmed with everything, Krata interrupted.
The slender woman nodded, the long braid of light blue feathers that ran down over her left shoulder bouncing with the motion.
"Yes, Emperor. Again, according to your orders, we've unearthed all the weapons that were used against the Domeki and then set aside."
He heard the confusion in her voice. His own research after replacing Marshal Drova revealed internal politicking that had been responsible for the loss of these technologies from their working arsenal. He said a small prayer of thanks to the gods for again investing religious, military, and political power in one being to avoid such nonsense.
"Very good. Continue." "The delay provided by the attacks on the colonies will permit an additional set of ships to arrive in time to take part in the battle, if the enemy acts as expected."
"And if they do not?" asked Chani.
Without turning from the Emperor's eyes, Malice responded,
"Then even more may be able to participate. As instructed by the Emperor, we are erring on the side of conservatism at all times."
The woman looked uncomfortable to Crada. It was in the rigidity of her stance and in the slight trickle of sweat that slipped down the tiny scales on her neck.
"You have something else to tell me? Do so."
"We've been forced to modify one of the traps that you ordered, Your Grace."
She stepped away and turned to the holotable. She used a combination of gestures to trigger the projectors in her gloves and interacted with the display. The image zoomed into the rocks that sheltered the home system.
"Your initial surprise for the enemy is ready, Emperor."
The display showed the modifications he'd ordered to the asteroid field surrounding the system were in place. The attackers would now be forced either to blast their way through the barrier, during which his own forces would wash in behind them to attack, or take the seemingly easier route through the weakened funnel he'd created. To their sensors, he hoped, it would appear a natural phenomenon.
"Continue."
A sweep of the High Commander's arms shifted the view to their home planet. He could see in exquisite detail his ships arrayed around it.
"The second trap is also prepared, with the additional forces set to arrive here."
A section of the image sparkled to indicate the arrival zone.
"The third, however, has proven to be unworkable."
Several vessels received outlines and then moved into position.
"Our assessment of the enemy's likely deployment means we cannot achieve the cascade we hoped for. We project they'll be too spread out, and we don't have enough ships outfitted to make it happen."
She stood tall and spun to face him. Crada folded his arms and flicked his wings out in annoyance. He took a deep breath and settled them back into place before he replied,
"No plan, however good, can anticipate every enemy move. I presume you've created an alternate option for this eventuality?"
His subordinate nodded and adjusted the image again. In this version of the future battle, the marked ships spread out in a wider dispersion against the wireframe projections of the human vessels. Crada tapped his chin, then let her off the hook.
"Acceptable."
He turned to his trusted two.
"Varin, Chani, any suggestions?"
"Mines,"
his assassin growled. He gestured for her to continue.
"We have more weapons than we have ships to use them. Convert the torpedoes into mines. Cover them with as much anti-sensor material as possible in the time we have. Then deploy them at weak points or bottlenecks. They can be autonomous or controlled."
Crada regarded her with a smile, then regarded Malice.
"Your thoughts?"
"I believe that's an excellent idea, Your Grace. With your permission, we'll make it happen immediately."
"Granted," he replied.
The High Commander gestured at a nearby technician, and she left the room at a run. Crada shifted his attention to his seneschal.
"And your ideas?"
The man stood with a dour expression on his face as he considered.
"I feel that the military side of the plan is adequate, Emperor. I have a question about the endgame. Will we permit these humans an honorable exit to become a vassal race, as so many have before?
Crotta rounded fully on him as fury swept through his chest and lit a flame in his skull. He opened his mouth to inflict a vicious retort, but froze in place. He was granted a vision in that moment, a vision of his subordinates' steadfast loyalty, and realized the question must have come from worry about their own sailors, not for the hated trespassers. Cool relief spilled over him and extinguished the lava. He extended his arm and rested a hand on the man's shoulder. To his credit, he stiffened but didn't flinch before the regard of his emperor.
"I understand why you ask this question, Johnny. Your concern for the lives of our sailors is beyond commendable. However, we can afford to give no quarter to our enemy, lest we fail to achieve the gods' will."
He raised his voice so all in the room would hear it.
"We must keep foremost in our thoughts the fact that the destruction of these humans is our path to paradise. They are to be eradicated to the last ship, and then we shall go forth and remove their colonies, their bases, and their home planet from existence. Only then can we be assured that our ancestors and all the Droshin people for all times to come will enter paradise once they've left this mortal realm."
He clapped his seneschal on the shoulder once more, then turned back to Malice, who was standing at parade rest.
"What of our final present for the humans?"
Malice called up a new display, and two more of the planet's defenders were outlined.
"All is ready for that option, Your Grace."
Crotta smiled. His fallback gambit against the enemy, should it become necessary, would wipe them from the board in a single grand stroke. He heard a rustle and a choking sound and snapped his head to the right. Johnny was looking away from him, coughing into a sleeve. From the other side, his assassin hissed a triumphant,
"Yes."
Crotta offered a small bow to his high commander. She returned a much deeper one, the scales on her skin shifting to a cerulean shade as her leader's approval washed through her. He turned and strode from the center, and they again navigated the checkpoints to the tunnel. Once there, he said,
"Are you well, Johnny?"
His peripheral vision caught his seneschal's nod.
"I apologize for the inelegance of the moment, Emperor. I merely sought an excuse to make eye contact with our informant."
"And?"
"He verified that all the High Commander's statements were true."
A grin stretched across his face, releasing tensely held muscles.
"Excellent, excellent. Now, all that remains is for us to return to the palace and relax while we wait for the trespassers to arrive, so they may die to please our gods."
Chapter 25. Fleet Captain Indraut Vray was greeted with suspicion when she arrived at the doors of the palace. The guards seemed on edge, twitchy, and performed their duties with an overabundance of caution. She was forced to surrender both pistols and all of her blades, save the ones built into the toe of one boot and the heel of the other. The guards' search lingered over those spots, but eventually concluded the thickness was just a feature of her boots.
"Fools," she thought.
She was marched through a series of public spaces with an honor escort of 8 soldiers surrounding her. She shook her head in amusement. As she moved through the space, her enjoyment turned to something darker. Every servant, every bureaucrat, every non-guard they passed displayed a palpable aura of fear expressed in their too quick movements and furtive glances around them. This atmosphere of perceived danger would be entirely detrimental to their ability to complete their tasks. Her frown turned into a scowl as they arrived at the grand staircase and found it barricaded, preventing admittance to the living chambers above. Indraut was required to pass through 2 more checkpoints before arriving at a small lift
not even big enough for her entire escort. She rode it up several levels, sandwiched between bulky guard flesh, and finally emerged into a sumptuous luxury that was the diametric opposite of the public spaces below. The hallway was softly lit with golden illumination welling from recessed features above. Ornate paintings hung on the walls, and she tarried to examine them. The canvases were centuries-old renditions of key moments in the rise of the church. The guards led her along the plush carpeting to a pair of doors where security protocols demanded another inspection.
"Please remove your boots," the senior guard demanded.
With a nod that gave away nothing, Indrat complied. Only then did they open the door and admit her into the working space adjoining the Emperor's quarters. The Emperor's seneschal, whose name she couldn't remember, escorted her to a chair.
"The Emperor will be with you in a moment, Fleet Captain."
"Thank you."
"May I offer you something?"
"Tisane, if you have it,"
she shrugged.
"We're aware of your favorite variety, Fleet Captain. It's already being prepared and should arrive momentarily."
He bowed and retreated from the space. The room was even more sumptuous than the hall. The religious paintings inside were masterworks and were complemented by sculptures, both small and large. In one corner, conspicuous in its simplicity, was a rough-hewn altar to Leilana. Indrat knew from previous conversations with her uncle that it was his personal one from his first church appointment. It was incongruous for this room to be so perfectly outfitted in the middle of a war. The feelings of peace and prosperity that abandoned those on the front lines appeared to have collected here. Perhaps that was as the gods intended it to be. It seemed an ill reward for the warriors, however. A small door set seamlessly into the wall at the far side of the space swung open, and the Emperor strode in, followed by the dark-robed figure of his personal protector. Indrat's eyes narrowed. There was an energy that accompanied the woman, a blend of violence and focused madness that put her teeth on edge. She pushed down the sensation and rose to greet her uncle, dropping to one knee before him.
"Emperor, thank you for seeing me."
Kratatok rested a hand on her head for a moment, murmuring some words she couldn't hear. He lifted his hand and said,
"Rise, Fleet Captain, and let us speak of the progress of the war against the trespassers."
He gestured for her to return to her chair, while he took a seat across from her. The Emperor's assassin faded into a corner to provide the illusion of privacy. Servants bustled in and left behind cups of steaming tisane and a plate of sweets. Indrat took the first, but declined the candies. The Emperor chose several and leaned back.
"How fares the Ruby Rain, niece?"
"Excellently, uncle. It's resupplied and rearmed. We've been given several sets of advanced munitions. My engineer believes he found a way to increase shield efficiency as well."
"It's certainly the right time for it," Crotta said. "Tell me about your attacks against the human colonies."
The corners of her mouth turned down slightly before she caught it and covered it behind a distracting sip of her scalding drink. She'd reported each encounter to the Emperor in a personal communication. It was strange that he'd ask for the information again.
"Each of our assaults was an unqualified success, uncle. In the last three, we were forced to flee from the human attack force, but not until we'd accomplished our objectives. We eliminated several ships of their response force, with no losses of our own."
"Very good, very good," he said. "As you're no doubt aware, the humans reacted unexpectedly to our colony assaults. Thus, we've had to refocus our efforts upon the defense of the home system. It's unfortunate. It was an excellent plan."
Indrat failed to muster a response to his rambling statement. He didn't seem to mind.
"Anyway, it's good you're here. We have in place several traps for the enemy as they arrive, and as Fleet Captain, it's important that you know them."
He looked confused for a moment and yelled,
"Johnny!"
The Seneschal rushed into the room and set a portable holodisplay between them. He manipulated the device to project an image of the asteroid field and adjusted it to provide visuals to illustrate the Emperor's words.
First, we'll control their breakthrough at the asteroid field. Our commanders are in agreement that they'll need to arrive beyond it or risk gravitic interference with their transport. Once there, they'll choose to punch through at this weakened point.
He gestured at the display.
Or they'll sense the trap and attempt to penetrate elsewhere.
Krata leaned back and took another bite of the sweets on his plate.
I almost hope they do. If they make that choice, our forces shall sweep in behind them and crush them against the asteroid field. A fitting end, don't you agree?
Yes,
Emperor, she said, the words flat and inoffensive. Should they penetrate the inner system, we have reinforcements hiding that'll ride a wave to appear behind where we believe the enemy will deploy. They'll be smashed between our ships.
On the display, that scenario played out, with tiny representations of ships darting to and fro, with those marked as destroyed, vanishing in an incandescent smear. Her experienced eye noted several flaws the strategists seemed to be overlooking, but she determined this wasn't the place to share that particular observation.
If this doesn't finish the humans, we'll use our sacrifice ships. I had ordered a cascade of explosions, but my commanders say that's impossible given the resources at hand.
His voice turned sharp and ugly, startling her. She fought to suppress a shudder at the personal menace in his tone.
Nonetheless, we'll drive them together in bunches and detonate a sacrifice ship in the middle of them.
On the display, unexpectedly large vessels were designated as sacrifices.
We're losing a great deal to make that work. Are we not, Emperor?
Krata waved his hand in the air.
Negligible. A skeleton bridge crew of volunteers on each ship in case our automated systems go down. But otherwise, the only lives we'll lose on our side are those too inept to clear the path when the moment comes.
An excellent plan, Uncle.
The best news, niece, is that we have two floating fortresses in play.
He reached down and eagerly moved the cups of Tisane into position to represent the battle stations. The Seneschal quickly adjusted the holoprojector to make the delicate tableware work as part of the display.
They've barely been able to handle one. With two available to protect us, the humans don't have a chance.
He sat back with a smug look and crossed his arms.
And that's before we consider the defensive installations on the planet. Within hours of their arrival, the trespassers' fleet will be smashed, and we'll be free to send our ships out to eradicate the stain of humanity from the universe.
In one motion, he stood and threw his dish aside to smash into a nearby cabinet. His wings unfurled as he walked to accompany the sweeping gestures of his arms. He tottered slightly as he moved. In another being, she would have attributed it to alcohol or other intoxicants, but she knew her uncle would never indulge a vice so strongly.
Everything relies upon faithfulness, Indrat. If our people and our sailors and our soldiers and our captains are faithful, we cannot fail. We will deliver our ancestors from the in-between into paradise. My name, our names, will go down in history as the promised deliverers of the Zhroshin.
He folded his wings inward and shocked her by crossing the distance between them in an instant and kneeling beside her chair. His eyes locked onto hers, and she saw frenzied, unbridled passion blazing within.
And I, niece, the appointed avatar of the gods in the mortal realm, shall join them when I depart. Instead of only 8, there will be 9, and lives of the Zhroshin will never be the same again.
He finished speaking in a conspiratorial whisper. Indrat gulped and suppressed a stammer as she said,
So may it be, Uncle. Hierarch, Emperor?
He stood again and replied, "So may it be," his rising volume echoing in the high ceilings of the room. He strode towards the door to his